The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. Margaret Wertheim, who's our guest curator tonight, is a science writer and the author of books on the cultural history of physics, including Pythagoras's Trousers, a history of the relationship between physics and religion in Western culture, and The Pearly Gates of Cyberspace, a history of space from Dante to the Internet. She's the co-founder of the Institute for Figuring, based in LA, which promotes the public understanding of the poetic and aesthetic dimensions of science and mathematics. And you might want to check out their website. They do some marvelous projects. From 2001 to 2005, Margaret Wertheim wrote the Quark Soup column for the LA Weekly, and she currently contributes to the New York Times and Los Angeles Times. In 2006, her writing was awarded the Print Journalism Prize from the American Institute of Biological Sciences, and in 2004, she was the National Science Foundation visiting journalist to Antarctica. And those of you who are here for the program with Dr. Christoph Koch know that Margaret is very gifted at communicating her passion for science to the public, as well as for selecting speakers to the series who are also passionate about what they've studied. So without further ado, please welcome Margaret Wertheim. Thank you.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be here for the second in our series. And those of you who were here last time will know that this is really turning out to be a wonderful series of talks, in part because the sciences of mind are at such an incredibly exciting time, both in their history and I think in the history of our understanding of what it means to be human. And our speakers tonight, I'm sure, will be just as rewarding as Christoph was. They're both a very unusual duo, a mother and son who have together written a really amazing book on the science of bodily perceptions of space. It's a very timely topic because new technologies such as MRI are now allowing scientists to glimpse the workings of the mind in action and to begin to explore how our brains are mapping and encoding space and spatial information. Many of you will be familiar with Sandra Blakeslee because she's one of the New York Times' most distinguished science writers. Much of her work focuses on the brain sciences, and she brings to it a very particular blend, I think, of insight and humour, which has always made her one of my favourite writers in this field. Outside of the pages of the Times, she seems to specialise in co-authoring books, which is something that most writers, myself included, wouldn't even dare to do. There's a particular essence of writing for me, and I think for many other writers, that it's a very personal thing, but Sandy seems to have developed a particular skill and flair for writing books with other people. She has co-authored, among the many books she's co-authored, one was the neurological classic, very lovely book with Dr. V.S. Ramachandran called Phantoms in the Brain. And another one in a completely different area was the Unexpected Legacy of Divorce with Judith Wallerstein. Both of them, I think, are distinguished by the insight Sandy brings from the sciences, but also an intense understanding of being human, both not just as a neurological entity, but as a psychological and emotional being. Tonight, her co-author is her son, Matthew Blakeslee, who's a resident here of LA. The book they've written together is called The Body Has a Mind of Its Own, How Body Maps in Your Brain Help You Do Almost Everything Better, which sounds like an almost impossible to believe topic, but actually when you read the book, you will see that it's actually true. It really is a wonderful book, and I wholly recommend it to you. Matt, her son, is also a science writer, and he in fact is distinguished by being the fourth generation of Blakeslee science writers. His great-grandfather, Howard Blakeslee, worked for AAP and was one of the founders of American science writing. His son, who is Sandra's father, was also an AP science editor. So we have to ask here, does it flow in the genes, or is it somehow been culturally brought into being? that today we have Matthew and Sandra Blakesley, who have in their own words become the world's first mother-son neuroscience authoring team.
Turns tonight. So I'm going to talk about 5 minutes. Matt's going to talk about 10 minutes, and I'll talk another 5 minutes, and then we'll open it up to questions. So we're here tonight to tell you that your body has a mind of its own. Now, you know it's true. You can intuit it. I think you can feel it. But, you know, how do you know? How do you know that your hand belongs to you? How do you know you have a body? How do you know it's yours? How do you know where your body begins and ends in space? So this is what we're going to be talking about, you know, throughout the talk tonight and throughout the book. Can we have another slide? Yeah, okay. So in exploring this, Subjective Body Maps, it actually sheds light on a lot of things that you would think are not related. So here are some questions that we are not going to answer all of them, but if you want to ask us during the question and answer period, we could get into some of them. So why do you still feel fat after you lose weight? It has to do with the maps in your brain. Why do you duck your head when you go into a parking garage? We can answer that. Why do you flinch when you see somebody get walloped in a movie or even on the street? How can you improve at a sport without getting off the couch? There's a way to actually do this, to increase the size of your motor maps. How do you treat musicians' cramp, which is when they flub the instrument, or golfers' yips? I don't know how many golfers are out there, but yips is it's a frozen body map. New ways to treat stroke and chronic pain. Why auras work, why they're real, why out-of-body experiences are real, near-death experiences are real based on the science of body maps, and how healing touch works. So we'll talk about some of these, but if you want to ask later about the others, we'll get into that. Go to the next slide. For the sake of what we're talking about tonight, we're going to be arguing that the mind is what the brain does. There's a big history, a dualistic history, Cartesian error in thinking that the mind is somehow very separate from the body. We're approaching this from the point of view that the mind is what the brain does, and the mind is mapping the body. So it's all of a piece. So next slide. Question, what's a body map? Next slide. It's not this. Next slide. I'm going to ask you to do a little exercise. I'm going to ask you all to take your right hand and pat your shoulder. Go down your arm, pat your hand. Okay. Take your left hand and wave it at me. And maybe do this or like that. Okay. So you just activated two body maps, two of the canonical first body maps that were ever discovered. Can I have the next slide? These were discovered in the 1940s and 50s by a guy named Wilder Penfield, an American who went up to Canada and established one of the first great neurological institutes. But he took an electrode and he started just exploring. So you see this thing where it says 37, 30 down that little strip? He would hit the electrode on the tissue, and there's no sensation on the surface of the brain, and he would turn on the current and people would go, "Oh, I feel that in my left hand." And then he would move the electrode and they would say, "Oh, I feel that in my arm. Oh, I feel that in my shoulder." And he mapped the entire, this side of the body in this side of the brain for touch. There's a somatosensory strip. The strip in front of it is the motor strip. He would touch it and people would say, their arm would twitch, their hand would twitch, their lips would twitch, tongue, foot, knee, back. So he, next slide. He actually mapped out, this is the touch homunculus, or the touch map. It's for the sensation of touch. So when you did this, when you touched yourself here, the cells in your body that map your shoulder were firing. Map your arm were firing. Map your fingers were firing. Next slide. This is the motor map, so that when you did this, the hand area in the side of your brain was activated. And when you did this, the thumb map in your brain was activated. Next slide. You can see these two maps are arrayed right here. There's this somatosensory strip, the touch strip, and right in front of it is the motor strip. Next slide. You notice this is called the homunculus. This is your body inside your brain, and you notice this is in the British Natural History Museum in London, and the sculpture shows you how really distorted your body maps are. The reason for that is if you think about the receptors, the touch receptors, you've got more in your fingertips, you've got more in your tongue, more in your lips, and a tiny bit on the, you know, on the back of your legs. So your body is grossly distorted inside your brain due to the array of receptors in your skin. Next slide. So animals all make their living the same way, with different motor and touch maps. Like rats and cats have these whiskers, and they've got whisker maps, big, huge whisker maps in the brain. This is the star-nosed mole, and it's got this funny little appendage, and that's the star-nosed mole, or called molunculus. You notice it's kind of its nose is so much bigger that it takes up about a good fifth of its brain, because it's like your lips and your fingers in your brain. So other maps. Okay, so I'm going to turn this over to map. Oh, sorry. Go one more slide. So there's a bunch of maps in your brain. Sensory motor, I just told you about. There's a map for proprioception. You have receptors like in your skin, but you also have receptors in your bones, your joints, your tendons, and your muscles. And it gives you a sense of where your body is physically, just embodied in space. It's called proprioception. Your vestibular map comes from sensors in your inner ear, and that gives you your sense of balance in relation to gravity. You have a body image, which is your beliefs about your body. That's mapped also. Peripersonal space map. Matt will be talking about that. There's a mirror neuron system. I don't know if you've had a speaker yet here, but I could recommend some to you guys. Marco Iacoboni would be great at this series. And Marco just has a new book out on mirror neurons. And this is a mapping system, so that when I did this to you, your mirror neurons in your brain that allow you to, your motor neurons, were firing. You weren't sending signals out to your own hand to do it, but you're actually mapping my movements in your own brain. So there's this sort of a motor sensory mapping that goes on in all of us, and that's why imitation, why we're slavishly imitators with other people's behavior. And then there's interception, which is the last map, and I'll finish the talk talking about the interoceptive maps. So, Matt.
Can everyone hear me okay?
Great. Next slide, please. So, now we're going to do another little exercise, just like Sandy did. This time, reach your hands out in front of you. And now reach them up. And I would ask you to reach them over to the side, but then you'd be interfering with the peripersonal space of your neighbors, and we won't go there. But this bubble of space around your body, as far as you can reach with your fingertips, is actually, as far as your brain is concerned, truly a part of your body. It's annexed to your physical awareness and self-concept. And this space has lots of very interesting properties. Next slide. Within this space, you conceive of the space in fundamentally bodily terms, in terms of your ability to reach, to grasp, to manipulate. What's more, you are constantly creating motor plans and patterns within this space, kind of like ghostly Shiva arms that are always going around you, groping, turning levers and dials and doing things, but only one, if any, of these motor plans do you actually select at any time to subserve your goals. In peripersonal space, even though your body claims it for itself, your body map network also knows that it's a construct and that other people have it too. Next slide. Forward, please. So peripersonal space can blend between different people in, say, martial arts. Next slide. Even with other creatures, the horse has its own peripersonal space, and the rider has her own in this case. And an astute rider and a well-trained horse will actually blend their physical capabilities to become more than each individual mammal. Next slide. With parenting, the blending of peripersonal space is very important for the child to learn how to become human. The next slide. And of course, lovers are just probably the ultimate example of peripersonal space blending and the duality dissipating, at least for a short while. Next slide, please. Tools are another fascinating aspect of peripersonal space. I said that it extends to the tip of your fingertips, and if you're not holding or wielding any tool, that remains true. But humans, uniquely as far as we've discovered, are able to really radically alter the dimensions and terms of how this space is used. If you consider this example, next slide. If you were to go blind or just blindfold yourself for a while and learn to walk with a cane, you would rapidly stop being aware that the sensations that you were feeling to use the cane as a sensory tool were being felt in the palm of your hand and in the force feedback on your wrist, and you would actually project the sensations to the tip of the cane. People have commented on this for a long time, but they were wondering if people were just being metaphorical or how it actually worked. And next slide shows how some very clever scientists in Japan trained monkeys very exhaustively to use rakes to manipulate things farther out than they could reach with their physical hands. And reading the activity of the brain cells involved in reaching and in the representation of the body, they were actually able to demonstrate how the receptive fields would expand at the tip of the tool when the monkey was using it or contract when the monkey stopped using it. The same thing is happening in us. If we use a sword or a pen or a hammer, and it gets more exotic. Next slide. When you drive, say, an SUV or a large car into a parking structure with low clearance, you might sometimes feel yourself hunching, ducking your head. You might even feel a little tingling on your scalp. That's not illusory. It's because your body sense, your peripersonal space, is actually expanded from bumper to bumper up to the roof, and you have corporeally merged with the car to a very real extent. This is also why you can feel and really understand the texture of the road just through the vibrations felt through your seat. It goes even further. Crane operators, looking at their hooks hundreds of feet away, have their peripersonal space projected at the end of the hook. It even happens with teleoperation of robotic arms in orbit. And it goes into cyberspace. Next slide. So one interesting thing is that this goes for cursors used with a mouse or a joystick. It applies to video game avatars. Next slide. This is a Nintendo game called Mario Kart. I've played a couple hundred hours of it, probably. If any of you are also familiar with it, you would know that this kid here who's playing is certain to be dodging and weaving, and when his ridiculous little cartoon go-kart goes around a tight corner, he might actually lean, trying to actually shift the weight of his cart. So your whole bodily sense, your body map network, is not just being co-opted by attention or by the little dopamine reward pings you might get for completing a lap or winning a match, but your physical sense of embodiment is just stripped out of your living room and placed in the avatar. Next slide. This has been taken further by the Nintendo Wii, which is a new video game system that uses not a traditional joystick, but one or two wands that have exquisitely sensitive motion and acceleration tracking devices in them. And so you can use these to control all kinds of video game features. You can use it as a tennis racket, or as a bowling ball, or as a sword, as the controller for a vehicle. And people get so wrapped up in the Wii that well, you probably saw some press about this in the first few months out. People were throwing their Wii controllers out of their sweaty palms through living room windows, and they were, kneecapping themselves on their coffee tables because they got so worked up over the sensation that they were actually wielding a sword and trying to just kill an orc instead of looking where the hell they were going. One more example. Next slide. This is from Second Life. People are very excited about virtual reality and being able to inhabit avatars. And currently, most people just do it on screen. But the most addictive application is using virtual reality headgear, which actually tracks the motion of your neck and actually puts you into a virtual scene that doesn't exist. The final aspect of peripersonal space that I will talk about, next slide, is called homuncular flexibility. The homunculus, as Sandy said, was Penfield's cute name for the somatic and motor body map that he discovered. It's Latin for a little man. It's the little man in the brain. And the flexibility is one of the, it's a very exciting aspect. Your body sense is actually ridiculously willing to be duped and to accept impossible combinations of sensory input and sensory and motor feedback, things that you've never even experienced before, and yet it will quite readily give up the flesh and blood dimensions that you've known your whole life and play by new rules. There are a number of illusions that subserve this or illustrate it. Next slide. One of them is the rubber hand illusion. In the top slide, you can see there is an experimental subject sitting at a table. In front of her, there's a rubber hand, such as you might buy at a Halloween store, and her real hand is off to the right of the frame. The experimenter in the polka dot dress has a pair of paintbrushes and is stroking both hands with identical rhythms and patterns. The subject cannot see her real hand and is only looking at the fake one. Most people who undergo this for a short while start to experience the sensations as coming from the rubber hand, just as if it was their own. In fact, the person who the scientist who first discovered this, he was just at a social situation. He had his friend do it, and it worked so well that it kind of freaked him out. He picked up the rubber hand, he threw it across the room, but then he followed up on it, and it's become a pretty robust finding. It gets even more interesting. It doesn't really have to resemble your own hand. It could be a gorilla hand or a lizard claw. They've even done it with driftwood and things that don't resemble limbs at all. Next slide. This was also recently done in virtual reality. The setup was that somebody wore virtual reality goggles, and what they saw was the video feed from a camera that was behind them. Then a similar thing of brushing both bodies, both the virtual one and the real one, with the same patterns, the same strokes, quickly made the participant feel like they were standing back, watching themselves from afar, as if they'd been completely disembodied. Other somatic illusions that can be administered involve the application of buzzers to your tendons and your muscles, which can do crazy things like make you feel like your arm telescopes in and you just have fingers sticking out of your shoulder, shrinking your waist down to hourglass size, extending your nose out like Pinocchio's. And they're just starting to try to work with these things to see just how far they can really bend the homunculus before it breaks, so to speak. One of the pioneers of virtual reality, Jaron Lanier, back in the early 80s was doing experiments like this. They did a lot of just playing around. They had a couple of very interesting pilot experiments that are just being followed up on now. In one of them, they created a virtual avatar, and they added several lobster legs coming out of the midriff, jointed legs, kind of like a crustacean. And the control signals for the legs were kind of read off here and there from the joint flexion and movement of other parts of the body. It wasn't something that anyone could really consciously understand. It was a very complicated math function. But Jaron Lanier said that he could sort of grok it, kind of intuit his way and actually gain control over these legs, which then felt like they were part of his body. And even more more vivid finding was when they made an umbilical tentacle sort of sticking out of the belly button of the virtual body, which was controlled with a lobster arm technique. So you could feel your way to make it swish left or swish right or up or down or stop. And they combined this with one of those buzzer illusions I was talking about, in which you have a buzzer in each hand and you play with the relative phase of vibration between them. Normally this just creates an off-body tactile sensation floating in between your two hands, which is interesting enough. But then combining it with the umbilical tentacle actually created the shockingly vivid sensation, in, as Lanier described it, of having this tentacle just added to his body. This took almost no practice. His brain was not rewiring over months or years like you might expect something like this to take. And I'm sorry, next slide. I forgot to advance. We didn't have, no pictures survived from the early 80s of this lobster avatar, but that's just a placeholder for it. So the conclusion of this this little foray through peripersonal space is that your body map network, your body sense, is really willing to work with new parameters. And we are just discovering this because we've never really had the ability to alter these parameters, except insofar as we have evolved to be unique mammals that use tools. That's why, probably why these maps are so labile and flexible. So it's sort of ironic that we're going to be using our body maps in the coming decades to increasingly leave the real flesh and blood body behind and explore new frontiers of embodiment.
Yes, very cool stuff, and it's just coming out of my... So, can I have the next slide? Okay, so I'm going to talk about this last system of body mapping, which to me is the most exciting one, I think, in my opinion. Interoception. So this is, how do you feel? And it's about the material me and the emotional me. Let's see, yeah, have the next slide. Interoception is basically your sense of feeling your body, and it's mapped in your brain, and I'm going to tell you about a special circuit in your brain that nobody really knew about until very recently. So you've got receptors on your skin that I'll tell you about in a minute, not touch receptors, but a whole different set of receptors. And you have receptors in your inside your body, in your organs, in your, Matt likes to call them your giblets, your heart, your lung, your liver, your spleen. You actually have receptors. And this is your autonomic nervous system, which has two pathways, parasympathetic, and these are horrible names, but sympathetic is the fight and flight, and the parasympathetic is the rest and digest. One is sort of approach, and one is kind of run away. And these are working in your body at all, every second, reading sort of the internal state of your body. Is your heart beating? Are you sweating? Are you hot? You're cold? And it's called homeostasis. You're trying to stay in balance. And it's a whole system that your body has for keeping you in balance, keeping you sort of alive. Next slide. The classic touch receptors that when you did this little exercise down there, these are the classic touch receptors. They're for pressure and vibration and a few other things. And there it is, the somatosensory cortex and so on with your fingers and your hands. Next slide. Shows you another whole set of receptors which have been known about for a long time, but they're just coming to light now in a new way in this interoceptive mapping. And these are receptors all along your body, in your skin, for heat, for cold, for sensual touch, like you give a baby or a lover, pain, what am I forgetting? Tickle and itch. Okay, and these are, you have specific receptors for these sensations in your skin. And and this again is being read off in a report, ongoing report all the time. Next slide. In the old model, which is still in textbooks, called the neural matrix model, this information from the internal organs and from your skin would go right over there to the somatosensory cortex. But after, like, it's been now 15 years of brain imaging, they have never found a pain response in the somatosensory cortex. It's just not there. It's over here in this different circuit, which is this homeostatic interoceptive circuit. And it has some different addresses in the brain, and I'll show you where it is in a minute. But there's an insula, anterior cingulate, there's a parietal insular cortex, and there's a frontal, it's got big boards, but it's a decision-making area in the brain. Next slide. The insula is an area that's tucked way inside your brain. When Penfield was going along the outside of the brain with his electrodes, you know, back in the old days, he never could get into the insula. The insula didn't really show up until brain imaging, functional imaging came along, and they were began to see this region of the brain. They always kind of thought it was subcortical, that it was primitive, that it was old, but it's turning out to be almost the quintessential region or circuit in the brain, what makes you human. And next slide. There's a reason for this. There's a cell type called a spindle cell or a von Economo cell that only exists in humans. There's this and a few other species that I'll tell you about in a second, but there's this big search in neuroscience, you know, what makes us human? What makes Homo sapiens sapien? What's so special about us as a species? And what's different about us? Well, one of the things that's different about us is that we have this cell type, and it's called a spindle cell. They exist in the great apes, so in the bonobos and the gorillas and the orangs and the chimps have them, but in very small numbers. They exist in elephants and whales, and I think they're about to report dolphins, which are, again, very social creatures. But humans have like 40 times as many of these cells. Don't hold me to that number, but a lot more. Like they might have 4,000, we have 40,000, something like that, as adults. Now this cell type is found right between the insula and the anterior cingulate. And this is where you're reading the body state, how you feel, the homeostatic sense of your body. And then the anterior cingulate is this area that produces action. So you have a sort of a sensory motor circuit for the internal feeling state of your body. So the next slide. When this information goes up to the insula, it's re-represented as social emotions. So all of the imaging studies of social emotions for lust, disgust, for excitement, thrill, nervousness, guilt, dismay, these are kind of a lot of words for these feelings, but they're represented in the insula, the right insula or the left insula. The information. So the imaging studies, if you feel the pain of rejection, it's in the insula. All of the pain studies in the insula. If you have a stroke in a part of the insula and you're a heavy smoker, you might wake up the next morning and forget to smoke. You have no more cravings from the body. And in fact, the National Institute of Drug Abuse is following this up. NIDA, as it's called, has been looking for ways to treat cravings for a long, long time, with very little success, and now they're thinking of ways to use actually feedback system to dampen the insula, so to reduce cravings for things like cocaine and things like bad drugs. Next slide. Let me just talk about pain for a minute. Pain is an opinion on the state of the body. It's like heat and cold is also an opinion. If you're really, really hot on a hot day like today, and you take a shower, a cool shower, a certain temperature water, it's going to feel just really, really great. But if you're freezing cold, you've been out in the snow and skiing, and you come in and you put your body under the same temperature water, it will hurt. It'll burn. Or a sidewalk will burn, or a sidewalk will feel cool, depending on your homeostatic state of your body. But a lot of it is opinion, and pain is pretty much an opinion on the state of the body. So the insula is reading this signal and from the pain receptors, and I think about 50% of doctor visits are for what they call somatoform disorders. You go into the doctor, and he can't or she can't find anything wrong with you. They say it's all in your head. Well, if you're driving the 405 freeway, or we came in tonight on the freeway, and you're just in this kind of chronic state of arousal, of anxiety, you will develop chronic pain, very likely, chronic backaches, chronic headaches, and it's lighting up in the insula. Because the insula is where this is being mapped. One way to treat this kind of over-aroused insula, next slide, is with meditation. or with all of the things for complementary and alternative medicine, Tai Chi, what are some of the others, acupuncture, are working on this interoceptive circuit and working to calm it down. When people meditate for 20 and 30 years, the left insula gets thicker. The gray matter increases in the left insula. When a mother stares at her baby with great love, it's hitting the left insula. The right insula has more activation for negative things like disgust and other kinds of pain. Next slide. So I think leave that one on. There's good evidence that in this interoceptive circuit is the sort of the center of awareness. We're embodied creatures, and we have these maps kind of flowing around in our brains that give us the illusion of being whole. But if you whack a certain map, for example, a parietal map, with a stroke, you will lose awareness of the space around the side of your body. If you hit it in a different part, you will grow four legs or extra arms, or you'll be able to, because this is, stroke victims have this quite often, they get these bizarre effects. So the question that I'm going to leave you with is, why do you think you are whole? I mean, you're really not, in terms of your body maps. They're working in synchrony, and they're working in time, and they're working in phase together, so that you have this sense of being embodied and whole, and me. You have a sense of being, you know, your own self, embodied, as far as your body maps are concerned. So we'll leave it there, and we'll take some questions.
The order of is that I'll have a little discussion now with Sandy and Matt, and for 15 minutes or so, and then we'll open it up to the floor. So there should be plenty of time for you. I'm sure you have as many questions and comments as I do on all of that. That you've obviously been extending your ideas since the book too, because there's so much richness here that. Extending what's in the book already. One of the things that I want to draw you out further on is that it comes up again and again in various different contexts that the body's maps are really incredibly plastic. As Matt was saying, you know, we're just beginning to learn now that through cyber techniques we can really extend our body maps so that we feel as if we've got a tail or wings or legs, which, you know, is quite extraordinary. It does seem to suggest that, as it were, the maps that we get in the first place might have some kind of culture, might be in some sense culturally shaped. And for me, one of the most fascinating aspects of the book was the area where you talked about how different people in different cultures clearly use their body maps in different ways. And I wondered, Sandy, if you could talk a little bit
Margaret,
more about that.
Well, Margaret gave me a wonderful example that I used in the book about the Himba, these people in Namibia, who have a word for the space around their body. And Margaret was giving a talk, and an anthropologist stood up and mentioned that about this, and said the Himba feel very sorry for us Westerners because we're always alone, and how could we possibly stand it? Because they have this sense of shared peripersonal space in their culture. Some other cultures, some African cultures, emphasize the sense of balance. They'll have like 15 words for balance. Some cultures, we're very visual in a Western culture. But how you see the world is shaped by your culture. And this is sort of a visual map example, but it's true for all these other senses, other maps. Asians see the space between objects, and Westerners see the object. So there's a guy in Michigan that does these wonderful studies, and he will show a picture of a tiger, say. It's a big, big, mean tiger, and it's a background of some rocks and some trees. And they scan the eyes of the lab rats, of students. And so the Westerners, students, they're going, looking at the tiger, and they're looking at the eye, nose, mouth, whisker, eye, nose, whisker. And then sometimes their eye might kind of fling out to the background and look at the background. You take a Korean or Japanese or a Chinese student, same thing, and their eye tracking is going, oh, rock, tree, river, stone,
tiger face, and then away, and they're not tracking the object, the center of the object. They're tracking the relationships between the scene, and they've done this with fish tanks and different studies. And this studies, just a new one came out this week in PNAS about the difference between perceptual awareness in your culture. So how you when you're born, Matt has a 2-month-old. She's so cute, and she's just learning to get control of her body, and she's 2.5 months. I mean, almost, but she's very smart. but you can see that she's just struggling to get this motor cortex going, and then pretty soon she'll reach out and she'll grab objects. So she's got some very rudimentary. That there are some basic, almost like a scaffolding in your brain when you're born, that the information starts flowing in. This little baby is getting. Motor and touch and sensual touch from her parents. She's getting lots of love. She's getting facial mapping going on. But she will build up and build up and build up these maps, and then she'll learn to walk, and then she'll learn to run. She'll learn to kick a soccer ball. She'll learn to throw things. And she will build up maps, more and more sophisticated maps as she gets older. And then she'll get these cultural maps from her family and from the culture that she's in. And by the time you're in your 20s, you've pretty much got this settled, and then you start making all your life. You make predictions based on this mapping, and that's what you do. That's what the brain does. It says, "Is this what I expect? Is this?" I gave a talk here with Jeff Hawkins a few years ago. That's what the brain does. It's basing all of its perceptions based on what it already knows. You've got this huge sort of repertoire of information about the world, and you're comparing it to the information that's flowing in at any one moment, comparing it to what you already know, and that's sort of, you know, how you think and how you behave. But we're cultural creatures. We're soaked in culture, and it's very difficult to escape.
Has there been any work done that actually maps different, does brain mapping of different people from different cultural backgrounds to see, are there any actual neurological differences that scientists have detected?
Yeah, I think so. And you'll get different activations in different cultures. I'm trying to think of can you think of a good example?
I'm not coming up with anything outside of language. A lot of the macro structure you see in the brain's maps does not seem to vary between different cultures or, you know, even among the genders, but you still see differences in behavior. For example, in this eye tracking study that Sandy was talking about, it's an amazing difference. So these differences are probably at the level that you can't see in a scanner or under a or just in gross anatomy. It's at the level of connections that might be traveling centimeters or deep under the tissue of the brain.
Right, but the differences are there, and I think that also psychology studies show these a lot more than brain imaging studies.
But how exactly they're instantiated is one of the big questions.
But it does seem to suggest that whatever is instantiated still remains relatively plastic. I mean, the fact that you could be convinced within half an hour in a VR system that you have a tail or an umbilical tentacle coming out of your stomach is quite extraordinary. And it does suggest, one wonders, what other sort of mappings might we be capable of?
Well, there's a lot of plasticity. So if you have an amputee and you have a phantom limb, a phantom is a product of plasticity. But we had a thing up there about why you feel fat after you lose weight, and it has to do with your body image, which is your beliefs about your body, and those are very robust. When you're an adolescent, you begin to develop beliefs about whether you're tall or short or fat or ugly, or whether you've got big ears or, you know, funny looking in any kind of way. You also have your political beliefs and your religious beliefs that are also laid down very strongly in mid-adolescence. And you hold those beliefs pretty much for the rest of your life. They're hard to overcome. And one of the arguments we make about body image is that the beliefs are, well, let me put it this way. Let's say you lose 35 pounds, 40 pounds, your body schema, which is that proprioceptive map I talked about, is going to have a very different size and shape. You're going to be getting different signals up from your body that you're really 35 pounds slimmer. But you may not believe it because of your body image, and you're holding that body image as a set of beliefs. Matt has a really interesting story about that with his height. You should tell that.
Well, yeah, I was a typical late bloomer in grade school and through junior high, and then I don't know. I shot up several inches. I didn't really notice it happening, but I hit 6 foot. I think around 10th grade. But I always considered myself a short person because I'd been shorter than my peers for as long as I could remember. It wasn't until college, one day walking around campus, I don't know exactly what triggered this, but I just realized that I was actually not short. And I was almost dizzying for a second. I just recalibrated. Boop! Whoa! Oh, okay. That's interesting. So this belief persisted in spite of sensory evidence that I was getting for a long, long time. And there are examples of this with weight loss, with weight gain, with aging. This is an example where the plasticity can take a while to catch up and can be very difficult to maneuver to reflect reality, or at least what you desire to be.
One of the things that I think is very nice about that story, and indeed about what you're trying to do with this book, is to, it seems to me, in a sense, overcome the history of Cartesianism. It's to really say that, and I think you say it directly or very early on in the book, that we are quintessentially embodied beings, and in fact you come out very strongly and say you couldn't possibly have a being that was truly intelligent without it being embodied, which is actually a very radical claim today as more and more people are trying to develop artificial intelligence systems. Could you speak a little bit about what you see as the importance of stressing us as embodied beings and why you think it matters to make this point as strongly as you seem to be in this book?
Let's see. Yeah, well, this is something that the artificial intelligence community has been, had struggled with for decades. They thought if they just put enough symbol crunching into together fast enough that they would get intelligence. It wasn't until the 1990s that people started turning it around and realizing that if you give your system the challenge of moving around the world, of getting different angles through sensation on different things that it has to negotiate or deal with, this provides you a lot of information that actually pretty simple systems can, much simpler systems than say the chess programs or the language translation programs that they were tinkering with all through the 60s and 70s. Embodiment actually, I'm trying to remember exactly what we argued in that chapter, but.
Well, you don't have to repeat your book, just say what you think now, Matt.
Yeah.
I mean, you argue throughout the book about the importance of embodiment, which actually is quite a radical statement to make. I mean, for instance, Christoph Koe in our talk here a few weeks ago, actually I asked him point blank, do you think that through artificial intelligence techniques we can have a being that would be conscious? And he said, yes, he does. And I think that is what most or many, many AI people still believe. But you're making the
claim.
You'd
have to simulate a body to do that, though. We use the example of Helen Keller. She's blind and she's deaf and she's, you can't have cognition without a body. You really can't. I mean, you can be blind, you can be deaf, you can be mute, but you can get along in the world with these other senses, but you can't get along in the world without your body. There's some children that are born paralyzed, but they can, like, and Christy Brown was an example, the people who's read his book, where he could move a toe, my left foot. Remember that movie?
Oh, okay.
But so even Christy Brown, who had profound cerebral palsy, was able to move parts of his body, and that was enough sensory awareness to build up enough body maps that he could be conscious. I would argue very strongly that you cannot be aware or conscious without a body. Mm. And even when you're paralyzed, if you're paralyzed from the neck down, in adulthood, you still have sensory input to your head, and you have all the maps that formed up until you had the injury. But if you were born from the get-go with no sensory input whatsoever, I don't think you would survive.
Your book also suggests that, in a sense, that, and in fact, Matt made the point very beautifully, I thought, in one slide, that part of becoming human is that, in part, how we learn to be human is by the relationship of our body maps to other body maps, mm-hmm. and the suggestion that I could not actually learn to be human if I didn't have myself in relation to my mother's body map, particularly, or, you know, some mother.
That's true of the mirror neurons, too, and they're arguing with autism and the autism spectrum, the more profound end of the spectrum, that the mirror neuron system is defective. Mm.
Yeah, so just like Sandy was saying with Helen Keller, our bodies are our fundamental interface with the world. All the other senses feed into our action and decision-making systems. They give us actionable information, and our senses are very high resolution, so we can make lots of distinctions. But moving around the world, fending for yourself, helping yourself, helping others, is really what it's the fundamental thing that life is about. Even in an artificially intelligent mind, you're going to need some kind of analog. It doesn't have to be a robot body necessarily, but you need to have some kind of external information that you're triangulating on and relating to at all times to build up your mind and to keep it robust. If you just have knowledge in a system, if it's just some airy intellectual expert system, it is going to be useful, certainly, as a tool, but it's not going to have the potential for self-reflection and self-awareness.
I was struck, Matt, by your examples of extensions of our body maps and therefore of our feeling of being that is going on with cyberspace. Now, for some time, cyber fiction has prophesied that we will have the ability one day to completely download ourselves into cyberspace and live without a body. This is the neuromancer fantasy. What your book would propose that this was a fantasy and that the idea of completely being a disembodied was very unlikely.
Well, it is logically possible that you could have your brain simulated to with enough granularity that this simulation in the computer would have the same or similar conscious experiences, especially if it was simulated in a simulated world with simulated physicality and objects and air and all these things. That's logically possible, and there are people like Ray Kurzweil and all these transhumanists who think that this is going to happen quite soon. They have lots of arguments based on exponential curves that I would love to believe. I don't quite find them quite convincing, but the next few decades we'll see. But I'm suspecting that those radical visions are not going to come to pass, that we're not going to have our brains downloaded into computer simulations thereof and go on living immortally in worlds virtual. But I nevertheless think it's very exciting that we're going to be able to interface more and more deeply with our brains and with the systems that create our emotional centeredness and our physical self-awareness.
And it does, your work, your writing in this book does suggest in many ways that our ability to train ourselves and to train our body maps into more healthy or more robust states is really quite powerful. And I wondered if you would comment, you have a chapter on athletes where you talk about that one of the qualities that might make athletes the great athletes that they are, is that they have, in some sense, those people like Michael Jordan perhaps have a better ability to construct and manipulate their body maps. Is it possible, do you think, that this will be useful in actually helping to train athletes of the future or helping us all to become better?
Well, certainly great athletes do have, they practice and they practice and they practice and they practice. So even like Tiger Woods has been playing since he was 3. And so they have really finely honed motor maps. But they also have this area, there's an area in your hippocampus, which is an area that you use for navigating in space. And there's a very newly discovered area called grid cells, which lay out like a holodeck in Star Trek, you know, that kind of space in the holodeck. If you imagine that being empty, you have a mapping system in your brain for the coordinates in space, three-dimensional coordinates in space. And the argument, one of the arguments being made about great athletes is that they really know where they are in space. Certainly people that play field sports like hockey and basketball and soccer. And when they're running down the field and passing a ball or even in baseball and hitting and things like that, they have this finely honed sense of space, and that could be an innate difference. Brains really are almost like fingerprints. They are different. So great mathematicians very often have a larger parietal lobe than Einstein had a very large parietal lobe, which is where spatial reasoning takes place, spatial mapping. It could be that great athletes have a more endowed grid cell mapping system. But all of it depends on practice early on. Some people are just innately clumsy and will never be able to hit a ball, like me. So there's, and people, you know, people like this, they'll knock over a glass at the table. Always, you know, they're just very physically clumsy. That has to do with mapping, I think, mapping systems, the parietal spatial systems of their brain. But great athletes practice and practice and practice, and they become, I think one of the arguments is that even the best, greatest athletes just work harder. Mm. And they're honing these motor maps. The motor mapping system is not just this primary map that makes you go like that. There's like 3 or 4 or 5 different levels of mapping, motor planning and motor intention. And those maps, is the more skilled you get, they become more and more automatic, more and more fluid. And then the primary output map is the last piece of the map, and the timing in those maps is exquisite in highly trained athletes. One thing that we talk about in the book, too, that I just love is about the fact that you can improve your motor maps. You can increase the skill in your motor maps just by closing your eyes and doing what's called motor imagery. And this is not like... So imagine you're playing tennis or skiing. You imagine that you're hitting the ball. Let's do tennis. You're actually thwacking the ball with the racket. Now, let's say you know how to play tennis. You've played it a few times, or you've played enough that you can return the ball. If you want to improve at tennis, you can actually practice with motor imagery. This is not visual imagery like you imagine yourself on the tennis court, but you feel yourself hitting the ball. That will increase the size of your motor maps. It'll increase the strength of your motor maps, literally, physically. So you can improve it just about any sport by using motor imagery. This study it's in the book, but it was done through piano playing at Harvard, and they were measuring the finger movements and
dart throwing too.
And dart throwing.
And is it does this plasticity remain with us as adults, or is it something that if you improve
Absolutely.
It at a certain age
for your entire life?
Really?
So, but you know, you can't learn to be a virtual violinist when you're 50.
Become Tiger Woods now.
Right, or Tiger Woods when you're 50. You have to learn when you're young. But plasticity stays with you till you die.
Yes. Well, that seems like a very good note to open up to the audience. There are roving microphones, so this person here, if you could just wait until someone brings you a microphone so we can all hear your question.
Yes.
Is this on?
Yes.
I was wondering whether the findings have had any application in physical therapy, particularly with amputees fitted with prostheses.
Absolutely.
You want to take that one?
Okay. Yeah. With stroke rehabilitation and with amputees. Yes. One of the newest things is getting feedback into the prosthetic arm. Most amputees, and I think I could say most, and especially in the military now, they'll give you three different arms. They'll give you kind of a wooden arm, the old-fashioned arm, and then sometimes they have arms that will cost $50,000 that have actuators from muscles on the chest. Most of the time, people will try those, and after 6 months, they throw them in the closet. They just say, to hell with this. It's clunky, and because they're not getting proprioceptive feedback, they're not getting haptic, with touch feedback. The newer ones are going to be able to have feedback, so they will close that loop so that you actually enclose it in your body map. We have a picture in the book of a woman named Amy Mullins, and Amy was born without tibias. So she was born missing her legs from the knee down. So from the time she was 1 year old, she was given prostheses. And every year or so, she would be fitted with new prostheses. And she said it was really hard. Like when she would be 7 or 8 years old, she'd be getting, you know, her legs would be a little bit longer. And it would take her a few days to get used to it. But then she would incorporate them into her body map. She's now, I think she's in her mid-20s. She's a model. She's got cheetah legs. You probably read about these guys. These guys are trying to compete in the Olympics now with their cheetah legs. They're carbon fiber legs. They can run really fast with these legs. If you absorb the prosthesis into your body maps, it becomes part of your body. So Amy's grown up with these prostheses. She doesn't consider them in any way not part of her body. They are absorbed into her map. If you're 20 years old and you've had your legs blown off in Iraq, it's much harder to absorb the prostheses into your maps without having this kind of feedback. So I wish the Department of Defense was better on this. There are some projects going on in Utah. I could talk to you later about where that's going on, but trying to make these prostheses work. For amputees, yes, amputees get these phantoms. Sometimes the phantoms are frozen. They'll use what's called a mirror box. And Matt, we're talking about the mirror box. Matt built the first mirror box at UCSD when he was an undergrad.
Do you want to explain, Matt, because what a mirror box is?
Of course. So often when people lose a limb, the map of the limb persists even though the flesh and blood limb is gone. Often the limb will be paralyzed and they'll just have this sensation that that their hand is a ghost floating out there in space. They can feel that it's there. This is kind of an oddity, but it's a real problem if there is pain in the phantom because you can't actually, you know, inject an anesthetic into an arm that's not there or massage it or anything like that. What I did as part of my undergraduate work with Dr. Ramachandran, who later Sandy wrote a book with, the prototype was just a cardboard box, and I put an acrylic mirror in the center. We had a patient who had lost an arm in a motorcycle accident. He had a painful, paralyzed phantom just sticking out in front of him. So by placing his good arm, his good hand inside the box on one side of the mirror, and positioning the felt, maneuvering the felt position of his phantom arm right in the opposite so that it was overlaid in the mirror image that he was seeing, and then moving his real arm, suddenly, he said, I think direct quote is, "My God, my arm is plugged back in." So his phantom was suddenly moving. The pain went away. We gave him the box. He took it home. And different amputees have different experience with this. I believe his phantom eventually just went away. His body map network just kind of gave up, said, "Oh, it actually isn't there." And that was better for him than the painful phantom. And this was sort of our way of, this was in the early 90s, so that was poor man's virtual reality. I'm sure they're working on more sophisticated variations on this theme now.
They're using mirror boxes now all over the world for stroke patients too. So let's say you've had a stroke. You put your good arm in, and the bad arm, you just let it dangle over here. You start moving it around, and it can just, through the power of plasticity, you can have gain of function. If you, now not if it's completely gone, but if there's some residual function, you can gain function.
Is this when you say you regain plasticity? I mean, are we talking about one session, Sandy, or over the course
weeks,
of a year?
Weeks and months of practice.
Right.
It's not really going to happen. Because every stroke is different. It depends on the severity.
Right.
There was another stroke rehab angle we discussed in the book, employing motor imagery. They used to just give you, and I guess in many places they still do, just give you a couple of weeks of physical therapy, and then they had long thought that neuroplasticity went away after childhood, and that your brain sort of congealed into its adult configuration, and that's what you had for the rest of your life. So they just never tried. They could have been doing this since antiquity if they'd only thought to try, of really keeping with the person, really using motor imagery, trying, just like Sandy was talking about with practicing sports, not as you might see it visually, but as you would experience it from the inside through your musculature and your skin.
And there's gain of function.
And there's much better gain of function, they're finding. But this is just working its way into
programs.
It's
interesting because Rama, we call him Rama, developed this back in the early 90s, and it's only now really making its way into laboratories, like 15 years later, and mostly in Europe, I have to say. Germany,
so if I sit there imagining myself,
well, that, and also using the mirror box. Mm-hmm. I have about 20 studies at home that are mostly European. So somehow there's a lot of resistance in the rehab world. They're really, really, so I hope nobody's here that does that, but it's it's really pretty, they're just not very alert to the scientific findings.
Is there a question over here?
When you mentioned Japanese, Koreans, and Chinese and how they look at pictures and Europeans looking at them differently, could it be that their language is pictorial where ours is linear and that that's one of the reasons why they perceive differently?
You mean their alphabets, their writing? They've looked at that, and that wouldn't explain it. I can just answer that off the cuff because the Chinese system of writing using ideograms is very different from the Korean one, which uses, what is it? It's I forget what the linguistic term is, but the syllabic structure the phonetic structure of each syllable is actually contained within each character, and Japanese is unique in world languages in using four different writing systems routinely to represent itself. And one of them is the Roman alphabet, and another one is, there are two Japanese syllabaries, and then there's the Chinese system of writing. They have looked at the structures of the languages. Again, Japanese and Chinese are very different structurally, totally unrelated. But let's see, I'm trying to remember. They did some analysis of mothers playing with their children, and it was not in the syntax or anything morphological in the languages. It was in how language was being used. A Western mother would say, "Here's the ball. I'm throwing the ball. The ball is rolling to you. Now catch it. All about the ball." And I think what I read was a Japanese mother was saying, "Here we are together. Now the ball, or I will roll the ball to you, then you roll it to me." I'm not doing the best job of reconstructing it, but it was just a much more holistic construction.
Relationship between the mother and child was more important than the object.
Yeah,
and they've done a lot of studies looking at that. So it's how, and actually that comes, I asked a colleague, or a colleague exactly, but a guy that we both know who's Japanese, and I asked him about raising his children, and he said, absolutely. He said, the worst thing that could happen to you as a Japanese child is that if somebody laughs at you from behind, if they're pointing at you, you fit into the group. The group relationship, the relationship between people, between your parents and your peers, is the thing that's most important. And so it's relational. And that turns out into the art, and it turns into the the brain mapping too. So it comes from the get-go, from the time you're a little tiny baby.
Do we have someone over here?
Oh, I was just saying, It sounds like developmental issues are very much an important part of this story. Are there critical periods in the development of, in other words, periods during which you must acquire certain skills or you lose the opportunity to develop them? Thought that you needed to be told that. And also, how does the insula mediate out-of-body experiences?
Oh, cool. Good. Okay. Critical periods are just fascinating, and they are there for certainly for the visual system. If you don't have vision coming in, you don't develop what's called ocular dominance columns, which is so you're functionally blind if you have deprived the eyes of vision, and then 10 years later, fix the eyes, and the people can't see. For all of these mapping systems, there are critical periods, but they continue to evolve. I could learn to go out and play softball. I would be terrible at it, but I could certainly learn it as an adult. But you wouldn't have the skill. But it's true for the auditory cortex. It's true for all these motor maps and all these parietal maps. About to the age of 20, are critical periods for laying down most of these maps, and they become fairly adult form, but then they continue evolving. Out-of-body experiences are so incredibly cool. Remember I told you the Penfield map. Penfield was searching for abnormal tissue in the epileptic brain. So there's this guy named Olaf Blanke, and he's doing the same thing today, and he's in Switzerland. And he had this patient on the table, and he had her skull pulled back, and she's lying there, and he's running the electrode, and he's looking for the abnormal tissue. And she suddenly goes, ah! And he says, what? And she says, I'm floating on the ceiling. And then he turned the electrode off, and then she went right back into her body. And then he turned it back on, and she's floating on the ceiling, and she was just dangling with her legs and her arms. And he turns it off. Now, she can't hear the electrode. She doesn't know when he's turning it on, it's off. It's completely silent. And she's giving this vivid report of being out of her body. When it's hitting the right angular gyrus, which is a little area which is kind of where the temporal lobe comes together with the parietal lobe. It's an area where space and objects come together, which is where the body comes together. A lot of the spatial awareness comes together of where you are in space. So he's found five or six other patients like this now. When Matt showed... I guess we didn't show this slide.
We didn't.
If you do it on the left side, left angular gyrus, people will get a shadowy, illusory person behind their back. It's the first time it happened with a woman. She was a seamstress, actually, a young woman, and she started to yell, and she's going, ah! And she felt this person behind her putting his arms around her. Creepy, creepy, creepy feeling. They turn off the electrode, the person goes away. Turn it back on, he comes back. And it was a doppelganger. It was really herself, her own body image, just projected out of her body. So these out-of-body experiences happen. And I think they are one thing that we don't argue with that explicitly, but I think that near-death experiences are extremely common. If there's an NDE.org website, and they're recording from all over the world. What happens during... an automobile accident, a stroke, a heart attack, you get a hypoxic, lack of oxygen to this region of the brain. There's a big blood vessels that kind of meet at this area. So let's say you're in an automobile accident and you're losing blood, or you're having a heart attack and you get this lack of blood flow. This particular region of the brain gets whacked. You're going to leave your body. You're going to be floating on the ceiling of the hospital. You're going to be floating outside of your body over the car. People report these things all the time. Some people report that they're able to leave their bodies and float on astral planes and come back and report what they saw, halfway around the world. We're not talking about that. I don't want to go there. It's a little too woo-woo. But people claim this is true, and they can make those claims. But for the rest of us, if you have one of these experiences, you will see a tunnel of you. They're just so ubiquitous, like auras too. There's a physiological explanation for auras. They happen all over the world to people everywhere. So I think that out of body experiences are a result of the right or left angular gyrus being hit by an hypoxic event.
Is that one of the things that's quite common? Is it's known that young women particularly teenage women, soon after they begin getting their periods, there is definitively they get more out-of-body experiences. And these are not people who've been whacked by cars or, falling, anything. Is there some explanation? Do we have any understanding of why that is?
I've never heard that, but I wouldn't be surprised.
I haven't heard about that either, but... Well, there are probably hormonal changes occurring, and the brain is seriously organizing itself all through adolescence. I remember, obviously, I never started menstruating, but throughout adolescence, I remember strange changes in perception. I just remember one time brushing my teeth and all of a looking at myself in the mirror, and all of a sudden, the person in the mirror was this totally other person I had never seen before. And it was just this fleeting thing for a second, and it went away, and it never came back again. I remember a little bit later in adolescence, it would happen to me constantly. I would be lying in bed at night with my eyes closed, and I would know the contents of my room. I would know where the north wall was. I would know where my bureau was, where the bathroom door was. And then it would flip around. It was just dizzying. Suddenly... It was like I had flipped north and then south and then east. It was always at right angles, but this was a vivid sensation. It kept happening, and then it went away eventually when I was about 20.
Could I just
so
ask?
So these things, it wouldn't surprise me if other things happen in other brain
teenagers
systems.
Teenagers also sometimes their bones are growing so fast they'll lose their legs. So these happen to everybody. And when they happen and you can't explain them, you have a couple of things. You can go, well, that was weird, like Matt. Or you can say, gee, I almost went to the other side of death. Or you can, you just have to make up a story a lot of times because they're so weird. But it happens to all of us. I think probably most of you have had some sort of slightly weird experience at some point in your life where you could become a little out of your body. And people, my daughter is a clinical psychologist, and she said that a lot of people, her clients, they dissociate. They leave their bodies, and they've had child abuse. And when children are being abused, they leave their bodies. And this is not, they're not actually literally leaving their bodies. Your body is not floating on the ceiling. It's happening in your brain, and it's happening because of dissociation of these maps. And again, I talked about the fact that you normally have the illusion of being whole and embodied and a person and aware. You are. And that's because everything is working in synchrony. But if you're growing too fast or you're in an accident, you can lose it like that.
I think... Yes. This person up here? Oh, there was this guy here. Sorry.
I had to say, speaking of your body extension, the route to San Francisco is usually quite fogged in, and if you're in an airplane, when you get to King City, you don't know if you're still flying or whether you're on the ground. Yep. And then it used to be that they turn on the guide slope when you got to near San Francisco Airport, and so the guy would say, plane so-and-so, you're so-and-so feet. People would be reading because you can't see anything. And then all of a sudden on one plane, the guy said, you're 20 feet below your glide slope. Everyone in the airplane lifted their feet up.
I love it. You know, and also, when Matt and I were on the radio one night, and we were, pilots, your peripersonal space, obviously you're a pilot, extends to the wingtips and to the nose of the plane for the shuttle. Shuttle pilots, shuttle commanders, when they're landing the shuttle, their body maps are extending to a 747. You're that big, you know, in terms of your body maps. People that are lost in the mountains will have extrasensory experiences. So, that's a very cool example. They happen to pilots a lot. Pilots will sometimes leave the cockpit and float over the cockpit of the plane. Jet pilots happens a lot because it's very monotonous if you're flying one of those fighter jets, and the fighter pilots will leave their bodies.
I'm not sure I wish to hear that.
But they report
it's an issue.
they report that.
I think we'll have one final question from over here. Frightening thought, isn't it, really? Next time I'm flying, I'll try not to remember that.
Keep your feet off the floor.
What is the interplay of language with these maps? Like, I'm thinking two different examples that occurred to me while you're talking. One is what the differences could be culturally. Like, for instance, I have a friend with an American father and a Japanese mother, and the father doesn't speak Japanese, and the mother speaks a limited amount of English. And their little boy has just been diagnosed with autism. It's one thing. But the other is that, like, when you said wave this, what if you had, you said wave this, but you did this? What's the interplay of language with those, that mapping function?
Language is a separate, well, it's all tied in. Everything is connected to everything else in the brain. But I don't think that if I said do this and then went like that, you would be surprised. And certainly the area in your brain that does this and does that would both be activated, your mirror neuron system. That has nothing to do with language. So, and language is, you know, we're very object oriented. We're very language oriented as a species or as in our cultures. But I don't think you need language for these maps to operate. These maps are operating on a different time scale and in a different area of the brain. There's language areas of the brain, which are in the frontal cortex. But they're, you can all these maps are working without language. You don't have to have language for that.
Though they, there's a popular hypothesis out there that the origin of language is actually in the mirror neuron system. This is the system we had to really be selective about what we covered in our talk, but the mirror neuron system is one of the most fascinating stories in neuroscience in the last couple of decades. This is the system that actually simulates, usually unconsciously within your own mind's body, the actions and even the intentions of other people. This system is it really underlies our capacity as social learners, as group, as team players, you know, probably as hunters during the Pleistocene, and also for our empathy, because we have emotional neurons. That's why if you see somebody crying, you might feel sad, even if you don't know that person. But the system for mimicking other people's gestures and the intentions that they might be using those gestures for, they think was sort of peeled off into two separate areas. You know, maybe one area was a copy of the previous one and then developed into a more semantic and abstract system that we now know as language.
Language would have begun as a gestural system, like a sign language, and then the motor apparatus co-opted it. So that your ability to talk is really a motor skill.
It's a very nice thing that, it comes back to the importance of embodiment first and the abstraction of language or symbolic language second, and then it really comes back to the importance.
People arguing that today, yeah.
Yes. Well, thank you very, very much, Sandy and Matt. I think that's a fantastic. And we will be, there are books available in the foyer, which Sandy and Matt will be very happy to sign. So please stay and get a book and join us for the next one in the fall. Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for coming.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.